All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Strength Academy. Mundo here once again, joined by Grayson.
How's it going, everybody?
And we have a special guest for y'all today. His name is Bill Waugh. And why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, Bill? You can start from wherever you want.
Okay. I'm originally from Iowa. Grew up in Council Bluffs, Iowa. And as far as the lifting, I did my very first weightlifting tournament in 1957. And I still in high school. And I still lift today in the Masters meets.
Okay.
As an 80-year-old.
And so that's a long period of time to cover. So what got you interested in weightlifting to begin with?
I got a magazine called Strength and Health that really got me interested. And then I was interested in wrestling. I wrestled all the way through high school and then through college. And I think the learn how to do the weightlifting helped on that, give me an outlet to develop strength and so forth. And that's what got me started, and then I just fell in love with weightlifting too.
That's awesome. So so you got your start, it sounds like a lot of guys that kind of got started when you did really only had a strength and health. So did you have anybody to hands-on like coach you when you first began, or was it kind of just trying to piece it together on your own?
I actually pieced it together on my own. When I went to my very first tournament, I had learned to do squat snatches.
Okay.
And I was the only person there that didn't do split. Everyone else did split, and I was the only one that did squat. And I did that because I seen pictures of Tommy Kono.
Oh, okay. So Tommy Kono, how did you learn how to squat snatch as opposed to
just
split?
Just look at the pictures.
Just like pictures?
And
wow.
I'm okay. Sure I just kind of picked it up like. Then after that first tournament, and when I was senior in high school in 58, I started working out with a Gary Deal. And if you look back, he's one of America's best weightlifters. He went to high school with him. We become friends because of weightlifting.
Right.
And he turned out to be the national teenage champion that year. And we went to my second meet. We went together, Kerr Cross, Iowa, to Iowa State Championships. And back in those days, we traveled to a meet and slept in the car until the weigh-in,
right.
Lifted, and then traveled back.
Oh, wow. So you, didn't stay out there?
No, I never stayed in the motel or nothing.
Oh, okay.
Probably didn't have the money or didn't even think about it. Stayed in the car.
Right, okay. Yeah. Well, that's a lot of dedication. So, you know, I feel like these days we're all kind of spoiled by either being able to videotape our lifts or there being more people around that kind of know how to do a little bit of that instruction. When learning, like teaching yourself to squat snatch and really learning the really technical stuff just from still photos, what kind of strategies did you get for knowing if it felt right?
Just by pictures in Strength and Health magazine. And then when I started working out with Gary Deal, now he did split snatches back then. He did change the squat later on. But he was a good, he was something else. He had polio when he was a young kid. His right shoulder and right arm looked like a bone with skin on it.
Okay.
One thing he really emphasized was squats. And he had legs that looked like washer and dryer sitting beside each other.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Give you an idea, he worked up that he can do 500-pound front squats for 10 reps.
Oh, wow.
And that was
500-pound front squat.
Yeah. And when you worked out with him, you had a hard time breathing because he took all the air in the whole room.
Okay. What weight class was he in?
He was mostly heavyweight until they started up the 110-kilo class.
Okay.
And then when they started that, he lifted there.
Okay.
And he lifted in several world championships for the United States.
That's a tremendous feat of squatting.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Most of the time, he moved to Seattle. And that's where he really become a good weightlifter.
Okay.
Or a great weightlifter.
Did
he was
join
good before.
A team there, or what was?
Yeah, he did. And I'm trying to think what it was up there. I should have probably wrote some names down.
Oh, you're all right.
It's okay.
Yeah,
no, it's all good.
But that's really That's interesting. So were you guys just training in somebody's garage at the time?
Or? In a garage or basement. I trained my folks' basement. In 58, I bought an Olympic set from York Barbell Club.
Okay.
I still got the bar. And I got most of the plates. I give my 45-pound plates, because everything was pounds back then. And I give them to my wife's weightlifting, powerlifting club.
Sure.
And they give me a couple of bumper plates in return.
Okay.
But anyway, because I broke up my parents' floor, concrete floor.
Yeah.
So he asked me if I could go out in the garage and work out. So I did that, and he just put down a concrete floor, and I cracked it. So he put me outside during the summertime, and I was doing snatches. And back then, I was a horrible squat snatcher, trying to learn on my own. No one else did it in our area, anyway.
Right. Yeah.
And one time I ran forward, hit the side of his boat, and dropped the plate, the bar, inside the boat, and some of them came out the bottom because of the wood boat.
Oh no. I'm sure that...
So he took me off to put me back in the basement.
Well, because it must have been hard. When did rubber, coated bumper plates start getting into, common circulation?
It had to happen now in the 80s.
Okay.
And because I bought from York Barbell Club, I did bought 20-kilo plates, and I still got them. Okay. And they was the first production of rubber plates known.
Oh, wow.
In the United States, anyway.
Right.
Of course, York was everything. And I still got them at home.
Okay.
And I still use them. And I still got the 58 barbell from York.
How's it spin?
It spins great. It's not a bearing bar. It's a bushing bearing. But I have in the past taken it apart
and cleaned it light a little.
Oil, mm-hmm. Cleaned it and put some light oil on it. A few years ago, I bought a bearing bar from Penley.
We've got a few of those, yeah.
Yeah. Glenn Penley was from Kansas, and I kind of knew him a little bit. We wasn't real friends, but we knew each other.
Right.
And so I bought a bar from him, and where it spins great. But you can see where I put my hands.
It's kind of wearing.
And I'm the only one to use it.
Yeah.
But it's wearing there. The York bar, there's no wear on it.
Interesting. Okay.
No wear at all.
Higher.
And now I use it in the squat rack.
Right.
Because it's a pound bar.
Oh, okay.
That's great.
Is that the same diameter as the current?
I think it's
bar?
The same. It feels the same.
Feels the same.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little rougher on your hands.
Yeah.
But it's because it's no wear on it.
Right. Yeah. The knurling's still intact. And,
yeah.
Okay.
So during those first few years that you were training, what did your training program
mostly.
I know that the 5x5 has been around forever and it's a tried and true, but did you have any specific programs or were you just kind of seeing what you could get up for the day?
Yeah, the 5x5 was real popular. I'm trying to think of the guy's name that he always said do five sets of five and then five sets of singles.
Five sets of singles.
Okay.
And he was one of the top coaches in the United States, and I can't think of his name right now, but it's from the East Coast. He's one of the coaches, Bob Bernarski and all them. Because Hoffman used to put this in Strength and Health magazines, different people's training.
Right.
So you go out, and next month you try another training, because he had somebody else in there.
Okay.
And then you kind of develop your own according to your weakness.
Right.
You always did the lifts, and you always did squats.
That's still, I think that definitely still rings true.
Yeah,
I really think that, looking back at what a lot of those early training programs were able to accomplish, you mentioned the 500 for 10 in the front squat, do you feel like over the years people have kind of tried to reinvent the wheel to some extent where, there's maybe too many kind of... complicated aspects to programming, and do you think some people are kind of confusing themselves when there's, practice the lifts and do your squats?
It sounds like, to me, people are trying to make it more complicated, And I think that might be because of coaching. And since I never really had a coach and never really trained with a in a group situation, right, I don't get that much involved in it.
Okay.
Only when I see in tournaments and people I talk to and so forth. And I know, I think some people in tournaments, I go and ask all kinds of questions about how they train and all that, you know. I think some of them get a little tired of me asking.
No, not at all. Because it's so different. Like, I wouldn't really imagine what it would be like to look at a magazine, see a workout, and then try to replicate everything that's happening in that. Like, it's an amazing feat to be able to reverse engineer lifting that in that way without a coach. So that's, that's like a whole different experience.
And still today, if I really kind of get stuck on what to do, I call Gary Deal.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
Just get some advice there.
Yeah, and he's been all over, you know, he's trained with, he likes to train in a group situation.
Right.
His last one was down in the Spoon Barbell Club down in,
where's Spoon?
In Phoenix, in Dallas area.
In Dallas, okay.
Yeah. And he's lived down there, and he's trained down there his last group.
Right.
So what would you consider your highlight reel of best lifts? And that can be in training or competition. Yeah. Any strength feat that you think is kind of
the only one I was very good at was the press, and my best press I ever did. And this is back when they had pounds, it's 305 pounds in the 165 pound class.
Oh, wow. So that's almost double body weight.
Yeah.
And that is also my best clean and jerk.
Interesting.
Yeah. I couldn't clean any more than that.
Okay.
I did one time clean to my chest 320 pounds, and then I was told to lower because the bar brushed my body. And back in those days, you couldn't touch. It was called a clean for a reason.
Yeah, clean of contact from the body, right?
Right, you couldn't contact your body at all.
Oh, okay.
It's completely different than the clean is nowadays.
Did you think that people had a hard time making that adjustment between, was there kind of a lag period once they allowed contact before people really caught up to what technique would feel like then?
You know, the only problem I had is when I lifted in tournaments around Nebraska, most of the people there never lifted in bigger tournaments. And I go to this tournament in Iowa called the Monroe Classic, and York Barbell Club brought his lifters down. You know, they brought Bob Benarski down. Shermansky lifted in it several times. And Fred Lau lifted in it.
Oh, wow.
Several
yeah.
times. He lifted, he come down all the time.
Huh.
And it was a big, one of the United States' big meets.
Right.
And I see how they lifted. Then I go and lift a meet in Nebraska, like I mentioned, and they are still thinking you're not allowed to touch your body. So as soon as I come in to try to get a better clean, I get red lights instantly.
Oh.
And,
set it down before you even jerk or press. Even then, you know?
Was that because the rules hadn't caught up yet to that region?
Yeah,
because
you know, they don't have it like they do nowadays, right. Internet and so forth.
Yeah,
you know?
Like a governing
but
body.
You're right.
Yeah.
The people who were referees and so forth in that area never even heard that you could brush your thighs again.
Interesting.
That must have been a wild time, because there, with the exception of a couple of very small rule changes, it seems like things have been fairly cohesive since, really, I guess maybe the elimination of the press, things have kind of started.
They changed the way jerk is performed. There's no such thing as no press out rule. But since they stopped the press, now they say no press out, you know.
Right.
And if you ever look at some of the old lifters, like John Davis and so forth, look like he wouldn't get any press pass nowadays.
Hmm. Yeah, I have seen a few like videos on YouTube of John Davis, and it kind of does look like he wouldn't have made any like lifts according to the rules that are in present
today.
Yeah.
But if they had the rules, I'm sure he'd still be a champion.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He'd have got
just
it
made
down.
Some adjustments, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And I've never met John Davis, but the ones I have met, they would have been great today also.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Because of their determination.
So with that, you know, accolade of that, that 305 Press, what was the, how much of your training time did you get dedicate to that? Because I know that the press is one of those things that a lot of the young guys in here, you know, people struggle to get their presses up. And I think it's because it's drifted to an accessory exercise rather than a primary. But what sort of things were you doing to help improve that press? And was it, you know, learning that Olympic style lean back, how much of that was kind of in play? What was the, some of the training for your pressing?
Mostly just plain pressing. Now, you start every workout for press. You did clean and press. You did that. Then you go to snatches and you do clean and jerk. And then you do squats. And it's almost the same today in a way.
Yeah.
Except nowadays, I know for me, I'll do like one of the lifts, like one snatch or the clean and jerk. And then I go into the squat. And now I do some pulls. And I never used to do pulls very much.
Okay.
You know, but Tommy Kono one time told me that if you did pulls, don't go that heavy because you can't pull as high as what you need to go. But if you go lighter, then you can clean and go higher.
Sure.
And you develop that strength in there.
And you do some more reps pulling it up with the right speed. That's kind of interesting because, yeah, there's kind of, you know, it seems to come up every few years, this, you know, kind of debate whether, you know, do weightlifters just need to deadlift more to clean more? Seems to kind of pop up from, you know, certain like sides of powerlifting where it's like, sure. if you just deadlift 700 pounds, your clean's going to go up. And that's not always the case.
Yeah, because your technique is different. Yeah, but I do believe if I had to do it over again, I'd do more pulling exercises because that's my whole weakness was my pulling.
Okay.
Like my best clean press we just mentioned was 305, which is also my best clean and jerk competition. And my best snatch was like 130.
So what do you...
Or 230, I mean.
230, oh, okay.
In pounds.
In pounds, yeah. So what do you think was like a limiting factor then? Was it your pulling strength, or was it like a specific area of the body that was like less developed than the others?
I had a bad shoulder all my life. When I was like 12 years old, I was in a farm accident. I fell off the wagon.
Okay.
They had me on top straightened up bales of hay.
Yeah.
And I fell off and landed on my right shoulder.
Okay.
And it got worse every year. And then a couple years ago, I did have a total shoulder replacement done. But even when I wrestled, it always bothered me. And I never wanted their wrestlers to know it bothered me because they could have a friend in a different school or a different college.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah.
You know? Yeah. And even a brother at a different college, I might have to wrestle against him or something. So I didn't want anyone to know about my shoulder. And I think that my pulls hurt.
Okay.
Pressing did to a certain extent, but it's a little different because, right. You know, when you shrug your shoulder up, your shoulder blade goes up, so you don't have that much turn.
Impingement, yeah.
Yeah, the impingement, yeah.
Yeah, that's what you call it, yeah. Okay. But pulls always hurt, so huh. I guess I was maybe on the lazy side on that too, you know.
That's fair.
Yeah, I mean, I think, finding the right balance between how much pulling you're doing and how much squatting you're doing is definitely a bit of a battle, especially when it's something that kind of bothers you a little bit. So what were, what to get up to that, 305 in, what is that in kilo, or for kilos, that body weight class?
Would be,
165 is like 75 kilos, right? That sounds right. Either way, what were some of your like best squats? Or we were talking a little bit earlier before we started the mic about using isometrics, and so what sort of like auxiliary strength development things did you kind of use in your training?
Yeah, they came off this isometrics, which you just push a bar against a pin, and I made me a rack to do that with, and in pressing, you did like you find your weak points, you know, like, and then you press as hard as you can for like 6 seconds.
Okay.
And just use the empty bar.
Right.
And then you do it maybe off your chest, and then maybe eye level, and then just lockout level.
Okay.
And then same way with the pull, same way with the squat. And believe me, doing squats with isometrics is hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
You know, and then they came out with isotonic, in which you actually put weights on the bar and you lift it a short period, maybe 4 inches, and then push it against the pin with weights on the bar.
Right.
So you do isotonic, they call it. And I like that better because you move the bar a little bit and move a weight.
Right.
And you can move some tremendous weight that way. Because like a squat, you could do the top of your squat. It'd be almost, you know, just a few inches and then against the pin and push as hard as you can. And we used to use, you know, 800-900 pounds.
Oh, wow.
And okay. That last amount.
And do you feel like those kind of big overloads?
Yeah, you have to be real careful with that because you could overtrain and not realize that you got fatigued muscles because it's a short workout.
Yeah, and short range of motion too.
Short range of motion too. And I don't see anyone doing it nowadays. Maybe someone does.
Well, because we're always kind of, we've been playing around with varying the heights of our squats lately, where doing half squats down to your sticking point and coming back up. So it might be worth playing with using some of those isometrics for kind of working through your sticking points on those squats. How many, so if you were to do, if somebody was to do some isometric or isotonic lifts, how many sets, as you said, like a 6-second duration, but how many sets were you guys doing?
In each position, you did one set.
One, okay.
But you might do like 3 pulling positions, 3 squat positions, and 3 pressing positions.
Okay.
So do each one once.
Right.
And even for the empty bar, when you do isometric, when you didn't use the weight, and if you did any more than that, you could tell it, and it didn't do you too fatiguing. It really was.
It made it hard to recover. Like
made it hard to recover.
Yeah, okay.
And were you training 3 days a week or more frequently?
We always train 3 days a week because that's what Bob Hoffman wanted you to do in his magazine. You always had a light day, a medium day, and a heavy day.
All right. Yeah, that sounds like a pretty workable plan. Is that something that you followed for the longest time? Like just a light, heavy, medium type of?
More or less, yeah. Nowadays, you know, I work out personally.
Right.
And I work out 4 days a week. But 3 of them are like weightlifting. And then 1 day particularly is for my shoulder.
Oh, I see.
And I do muscle snatches and presses for my shoulder. And the doctor told me when I got done, I can lift it, do whatever I want to, don't lift more than 20 pounds overhead. Of course, I'm sure he doesn't know what weightlifting really is, you know. But the pressing, which is always my best lift, is really kind of more my weakness now because of my shoulder. It does catch it there and so forth. And, anyway, I got a certain goal that I want to try to do, doing the military press again, and I don't know if I ever reach.
What are you shooting for?
Okay, it's actually 50 kilos.
Okay, that's a good goal to have, sure. Especially after like a shoulder rebuild and then rehabbing it. Yeah, definitely.
So I can actually jerk more than I can press now, which I couldn't do that before.
Okay. Well, your jerk technique's improved.
It really has. I've been doing a lot of stretching for that. That muscle under here, I think, needs to be stretched out.
The lats.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's, we've definitely noticed that, you know, if you're struggling with, like, locking out, it's usually that lat-tricep combo that tends to restrict folks in there.
But, since I still work out by myself most of the time, I do get on, like, Catalyst Athletics.
Yeah.
With Greg, and he's got some good stuff in there.
Yeah, he's definitely a resource that I've used like as part of my coaching education, like from the beginning. His book is super comprehensive, and he's always got interesting tips. And I like his stuff because it's very principles based. So he's not trying to sell like this is the one way to do things. It seems like he really cares about like, no, these are kind of the basics, and how you put them together is kind of based on the individual.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I like Greg Everett's approach because it's more of like, here's what works, and you know, if something else, you need to do something else to change the way it works for you as an individual, then you can do that. But like, here's just some general stuff. It's not like he's preaching a specific way of lifting or his way of lifting. It's more like, this is how I've trained lifters in the past and what has worked for me.
So one more thing that kind of comes up a lot and that people might overthink these days as well is, as far as nutrition and recovery and like using any sort of recovery modalities, what did you guys kind of focus on in your early days of training around nutrition or how to recover better from workouts?
Okay, once again, Bob Hoffman was the guy. He wrote Strength and Health magazine. He traveled the country. He brought teams to tournaments and all that. And he sold protein powder and other things.
Right.
Xeritol was one of the things he sold, which was some kind of a something anyway. So we always thought, you buy Hoffman protein powder. Okay. And he made the most delicious peanut butter protein bars that was so good.
Okay.
And you buy them in health food stores and all that. And I used to buy them by the boxes, you know. And I'd say that's the only thing I did differently besides I always believed in milk.
Yep.
And of course, when I was a young kid, I was a real fan of the Lone Ranger, and he sold Cheerios.
Right. Yeah.
So we ate Cheerios and Wheaties, Breakfast of Champions, like, you know, like that. My dad, who was didn't have any education at all, he grew up during the Depression, and then he fought in World War II. So he never had a high school education. But he believed that if a person ate peanuts and milk, you get a complete nutrition. Hmm. And you know, when you look at it nowadays,
it's not far off.
It's not far off. He is one of the smartest persons I ever met, and yet he never had an education.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, regardless of how much formal schooling you've had, I think we've all met people with tremendous amounts of schooling that you're not particularly impressed with,
right.
Or somebody who hasn't done anything formally but is just intuitively very with it. Yeah. I think that's kind of...
But my parents and their family was mostly farmers, so they really believed in eating like meat. You know, my mom was really big in liver.
In the liver, okay. A lot of vitamins in liver, yeah.
And so she always had that once in a while, and it was always so good. I don't think I had it since I've been at 20, 30 years anyway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You'll have to find yourself a good recipe.
Yeah.
It works. So, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that I really feel is that once you kind of start getting into weightlifting, it kind of takes a hold over you, and you get, you know, you kind of start centering your life around these things. And one thing that I really admire is, you know, I think I saw you compete in 2014 or 2015 at one of Joaquin's meets. We had an athlete trying to qualify for the universities, and one of the things that kind of fascinated me is, so what do you feel is like, what about the lifts has kept your interest for so long?
It's their hard work, and the train form is hard work, and I love hard work. That's, I always have.
Yeah.
I always felt I didn't have enough physical and mental ability to compete against someone really good in any level, or my work or whatever. So I always had to outwork them. And that's the only way I can make it, is outwork them. And I got where I just love hard work. And I think weightlifting is hard work.
Absolutely.
I definitely agree with that, yeah.
And I don't know anything like the snatch and clean and jerk. I don't, and including the press in there, but as an exercise, a better way to exercise. I don't know of a better way.
Was it kind of confusing seeing people drift away from the compound lifts in the 80s and more towards machine-based workout programs? Was that kind of an odd observation?
It is. And the reason why, Arthur Jones, who invented the Nautilus, he was a weightlifter. He's even competed in the Nationals. Back in the days, they only take the top five or so lift in the Nationals, that's it.
Oh, wow.
And one year, I think he came in second or something. He developed the Nautilus machines. And he used to travel around the Midwest a lot, mostly because Perry Rader was in Lyons, Nebraska. And he had that Iron Man magazine.
Okay.
And he was also one of the top guys in weightlifting as far as the administrator. So you see Arthur Jones, there would be a tournament, you see him coming in with a pickup with a machine in the back. And then he's trying to sell his machine to people. But he always tried to tell everybody, you have to have a machine that's built for you because of your fulcrum points. And if it's not built for you, you're going to get injured or develop in a way in which you're going to get injury in the future.
Sure.
Because it has to be built for you.
Oh, that's okay. Interesting.
Then he found out later on, if he can sell them to a gym, so anybody can use them, he can make more money.
Right.
And he become a millionaire. And because of him, that's one reason I've been against machines.
Yeah.
Because what he used to say.
yeah, that makes sense. Because like when you take somebody that's been weightlifting and then all of a sudden they're building machines that are counter to what you've been working on, it's a little strange.
So I always tell everybody that machines, I think, is great for bodybuilders. They help pump up the muscle,
mm-hmm.
full of blood, so you look like a bodybuilder. Or maybe, like weightlifting, maybe don't make you look like a bodybuilder. But anyway, another thing with machines does, if you have an injury and you have to rehabilitate it, a machine, and that particular one will help. When I had my shoulder redone, they had me do that little bicycle with the hands.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And several other little things for my shoulder. And I think it helps for that. And the third thing I think that helps on is people don't know how to work out.
Yeah, yeah.
They can go to a gym and work out machines.
Right.
That's my feeling about machines.
Yeah, there's definitely like a lower amount of buy-in. And that's something that, you know, we talk to people all the time when they're joining the gym for the first time is, it's going to be kind of hard to learn this at first. And it's going to take a little while before you feel like you're in the groove. But I think that's like you said, that amount of hard work that it takes to get good at snatching or to get good at clean and jerking, there's skills that you can carry over into dealing with other things in your life that are kind of hard.
Right.
So do you feel like you had like the skills that you developed in weightlifting, were you able to kind of apply those to your kind of that same tenacity to career or family? Or?
Yeah, I think so. I know one reason why I started doing it is to help my wrestling, and it helped it tremendously. And at least I got a scholarship, you know.
Scholarship.
I'm sorry about my pronunciation.
No, it's all good.
But so I did get my way paid through college, you know.
That's outstanding, yeah.
And I never did work out with weights during the wrestling season, except maybe I do a few presses. And that was about it, really.
Was that because you didn't want it to interfere with your wrestling training, or were you afraid that it would cause some problems?
Right. And it wasn't that well looked on at that time, too, among the coaches, you know. As soon as the wrestling season's over again, I was back on it and going to tournaments.
Okay.
Well, do you think that having that kind of time for having an off season is good for like kind of long term athletic development, like finding a way to kind of cycle your training so you're not pushing 100% year round?
I think so. Cause I've seen so many kids nowadays that get hurt. I got some nephews and nieces that play like soccer and so forth, and they do it all year round. And they get hurt, and they're having surgery done their knees and all that. And I think if they took some time off and did weight training to build some things up, maybe that wouldn't cause things. I don't know.
Yeah, I think.
I'm no doctor, or I'm not even a physical therapist, you know. So I don't have the authority to say which for sure. But I think it helps.
Yeah, it just makes them more robust athletes, right?
Right.
More injury prevention because they're stronger.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, and if you look at all the, you know, best strength and conditioning programs, you know, a lot of people are coming around to the use of the Olympic lifts and full depth squats. That would be another thing. You probably witnessed firsthand the panic over squatting to full depth. Do you remember a time when it switched from squat all the way down to don't let your knees go forward and stay kind of high?
Yeah, but I never bought into that. I always believed that if your knees went the same direction your toes were going, you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
Now, as far as stopping on depth, I understood it was almost like putting brakes on in a car, and which you're going to wear them brakes out. But if you go all the way down and all the way back up, you have less wear and tear on your knees and so forth. And I really still believe that. Because I don't know hardly anyone that does full squats that ever had problems, unless they got hurt doing something else.
Yeah.
Hardly ever from doing squats, it's always getting, like football players, they really get bad knees.
Yeah, you get a lot of concussions and usually, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's from getting hit from the side and so forth like that. But I think if you keep your knees over your toes, you're not going to get bad knees. That's all there is to it.
Okay. Yeah, maybe a little.
Like overuse. I said, though, I'm no doctor.
Right. Well, yeah, but more training experience than most doctors for sure. Because you've been squatting pretty much every week since, what did you say, 56?
Yeah, probably 55 is probably when I really started lifting. 57 is when I went to my first tournament.
Okay. That's really awesome. So I know that you and your wife are both lifters. Today, has she always been a part of, like, since you guys have been together, or?
No, she used to always go to gymnasiums and always liked working out in a gym. And she always liked having a personal trainer for just to make herself feel good and look good, you know. And then in 1960, she was over here at Gold's Gym in Rio Rancho, which is no longer there. And her doctor mentioned something that she ought to do something that's weight bearing, and the machine just wasn't doing it. And she went over there and talked to some power lifters, and they started training her for powerlifting. And then they challenged her one time to enter a tournament in 1960. And so she did that. She couldn't even deadlift with the 45s on.
Okay.
Okay. But she loved the tournament because she's the only one in her age group and weight class, and they give big trophies. And
yep.
And you can't believe the trophies she has now.
Okay.
It's awesome.
Yeah, I've heard she has quite a bit.
Yeah.
So how important, like, one thing I love seeing that, you know, you and your wife are both so involved in both weightlifting and powerlifting as far as the communities go. You know, you guys are at every meet. And do you feel like having that kind of shared interest has been kind of important for your guys' relationship to kind of have these kind of interests that are slightly adjacent but very much in common?
I'm sure it has a thing in it, but I think so much of her that, even if we didn't have that in common, I think we would still be like we are now. I got so much respect for her and everything.
Okay. Well, and how long have you guys been married?
It'll be almost 40 years now.
40 years? Wow, that's a long time. Yeah.
And this is our second marriage. We both had our families with our first marriage and so forth. And even though I wish I could have met someone like her to begin with, it's still, you know, I wouldn't want to give up my girls I have.
Yeah, of course.
And so forth. And she wouldn't want to give up her boys. It still is the development years. But when I first met her, I knew that was it.
But it's something that you guys have always supported each other in, right? You've supported her goals as far as being a powerlifter, and she's supported you as far as being a weightlifter goes?
Yeah. Yep. And, you know, I kind of become a powerlifting referee, just like when I go to meets, I have something to do.
Yeah, of course.
Because I'm not really that thrilled with the powerlifting, but I don't dislike it because now I got a lot of friends that do it too, mostly because of her.
So what would you, as someone who's been successfully married for 40 years, do you have any kind of insights on keeping a relationship healthy over the long run?
Well, I think the main thing is respect for each other. That's the main thing, because if we have different, you know, we both can have different ideas of what we like to do. Mm-hmm. Like she likes to go out to eat more than I do.
All right.
Things like that, you know. Yeah. We hardly ever eat the same kind of foods, you know. So we can't split a meal that often.
Sure.
It'd be nice if we just split a meal, because at our age, we don't eat that much anymore. But she's different than I do. And, you know, so what, you know?
Still make it work, right?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, because I think that, you know, if people are identical, then there's not really any.
Yeah, if two of you are the same, one of you is obsolete, right?
Yeah. You know, and I'm, you know, I'm just a short, bald-headed guy, and she's a beautiful lady, so we're different right there.
So, you know, as far as continuing on the advice train, you know, so for any of these guys who are kind of trying to make their way up now, do you have any kind of, you know, advice for the long term and keeping, you know, for young lifters?
For weightlifting?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, from what I've seen, to get a good coach, even though I haven't been coached, I really think, and I know so many guys, like Gary Deal wasn't coached until he moved to Seattle, but then he got a good coach and made a big difference for him. Tommy Kono never had a coach, and some of the great ones never did. But I really think nowadays it's getting so technical. I think having a good coach not only could avoid an injury,
yeah,
but also keeps you, starts you out right.
Yeah, it shortens the learning curve too.
Like, shortens the learning curve.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's one thing I'd really would recommend with people. I have a lot of people that do once in a while want me to show them what to do. I don't want to be a coach. I don't think I'm trained for it. So I usually tell them to find a good coach.
Okay. And along those lines, like what would you do in your training to recover from your workouts? Like what kind of methods were available to you, and what would you use as far as how you would recover from your training?
I always was told, even back in wrestling, the best thing you can do is sleep and get rest. And I know not too long ago, I think it was on a bar bin or something they had in there, that the best steroid is sleep.
Sleep, yeah.
And you know, I always believe that that's the main thing, is recovery like that.
Okay.
And nowadays, I don't take any, the only vitamin I take is a vitamin D. The
yeah.
doctor told me one time that on my age and everything, because I don't get out in the sun, even though I walk every day, I need vitamin D. And then I take a small baby aspirin, because my family history of heart problems.
Oh, okay.
And those are the only two things I take.
Okay.
That's not food, you
right.
know.
Yeah, and I think that's an important thing for weightlifters too, because I myself, my doctor told me that I was vitamin D deficient. But I spend a lot of time inside, both weightlifting and in general. So like, I'm in the same boat. Like, I have to take a vitamin D supplement to kind of just make sure that I'm getting that vitamin.
Right. And getting vitamin D is still, it's not in very many foods unless it's
right.
fortified.
Right.
But the best way to get it is the sun, naturally. And but evidently I don't.
Yeah, yeah.
The doctor told me one time I shouldn't. And that's the only thing I ever been noted, that they ever noted that it was deficient in any food.
Sure.
Everything else besides milk, I always drank a lot of milk, because when I grew up, that's what you're supposed to do.
Right.
And I still drink milk. I drink mostly skim milk now, mostly just because of weight control.
Right.
But I still drink milk. But besides milk and water, everything else I want to be able to chew.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
Well, and I think that the sleep is so pivotal, and that's, I think, one of the things that's harder nowadays for people is that we've all got these screens in our pockets all the time that, you know, keep you up, like, way later at night, and that's one of the hardest things that I have talking to athletes is, you know, you need to sleep 8-9 hours
And getting people to break the habit of only sleeping for six is, you'd think that it would be an easier sell because it's so enjoyable, but I think people feel guilty for sleeping a lot.
Yeah,
I don't have like a TV in our bedroom or anything.
Well, that's probably for the best. Like, you don't want that screen to be interfering with, you know, your ability to fall asleep and things like that. But yeah, that's usually like when people spend a lot of time in front of the TV right before bed, they end up having, you know, a little bit less quality sleep.
And that's one thing different too, when we just mentioned about in my wife and I being different. I don't really like to watch TV. My wife loves to watch it. And she especially likes to watch like the Hallmark station. I call them the chick flicks.
The chick flicks.
You know, and I don't really care much for that. Now, I have got where I use the computer a lot, and I look things up.
Sure.
And I'm always thinking I'm studying and learning, you know. And that could have been because of the way my parents were. Since they didn't have an education, they always learned things. They wanted to spell. My mom could spell like you couldn't believe, you know, and she never went to high school.
Sure.
You know. And my dad was, he can write beautifully writing. But he never had a, but he didn't want anyone to watch, see him write and think he didn't, wasn't educated. And I can't do the things that they used to do. You know, I can't.
Yeah.
But they used to practice it all the time.
So that kind of, you know, ever learning, what are some topics that you've been kind of fascinated by lately? What have you been studying?
You know, I like history a lot. I read quite a bit on the internet. Today they had an article about George Washington. And even though you always hear about Washington through school and everything, I still read that whole article and learned a few things, you know.
Yeah, no, I think it's so important to, you know, I think, you know, looking at you guys kind of moving around and you're just, you know, are you both in your 80s now?
My wife is, she'll be 79 next month.
And, you know, just seeing that you guys are so active and out, and, like, I think that, you know, part of it is that physical outlet, like, still exercising, but I think that, you know, constantly learning is one of those things that I think we fall out of the habit of reading or studying. What are some of your favorite, if you're, you know, reading a lot, like, do you stick mostly to nonfiction history stuff?
Or? Yeah, I don't care much for fiction. Maybe that's the reason why I don't watch a whole lot of TV or watch movies so much, because most of that is fiction, you know. But I like to learn, you know, facts about things, you know.
Is there a particular part of history that you're more fascinated with than others?
Not really. You know, I like the back in the old time football players like Dick Butkus.
Okay, yeah.
And people like that, how they become so good. And I like to read about that too, you know.
Yeah, because those guys kind of had a similar era, right, where everything was starting off and like there wasn't this big plan or this big organization. The NFL didn't exist in the way it does now. They were just figuring things out, and they were just kind of moving the ball along.
I'm sure it's just like it was in weightlifting.
Yeah, exactly.
How it evolved out, you know. Because everyone used to go, everyone worked out in a basement or a garage.
Right.
No one had a gym to go to, you know. And so that's how they learned. Sometimes I go and work out with somebody, and just to see how they did it, you know. And some of them came over and worked out with me. That was fun. Learning things like that.
Yeah, I feel like now that everybody's kind of got their home bases of gyms, there's a lot less of that just popping over to lift with someone for a good time.
Yeah.
There's a little bit more competition when business gets involved, and I think that's kind of too bad, because I think it's sometimes kind of fun to, you know, pop in and hang out with a different group of folks.
Yeah.
But yet, I think it's great to have teams and so forth, but I have seen frictions between teams.
Yeah,
maybe it's more the coaches.
Maybe, yeah.
You know, I don't know, because maybe sometimes they make their living that way, and I can understand that to a certain extent, I guess. But I've never seen that before until revenue.
Is it more centered around like when a coach loses a lifter to another coach, or just like the coaches don't get along in general, or?
I think what starts it when they lose a lifter.
When they lose a lifter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like that what starts it, and then there's a little bit of jealousy. Yeah, it'd be hard to take personally.
Yeah, especially because like when you're training athletes, you're investing a lot of time and energy into them, and then when they decide that the place isn't for them, or maybe they want to move to a different coach, that's I could see how people would take that kind of like personally, but I could see how it happened.
Well, and that's where I think the, you know, keeping in mind the, like, you know, kind of on a philosophical matter of, you know, just think like recognizing impermanence in things.
Yeah.
Really helps you, because, you know, we've had a couple people move just because they wanted something slightly different, or they're in a different part of town. And, you know, it always hurts when you lose a lifter or anything like that. But if you just kind of recognize that, you know, it's, you can't keep everybody around all the time. And
and at the end of the day, I mean, people are going to do what's best for them. And hopefully it helps them grow. And, you know, you just wish them the best wherever they're at.
One time we was making a trip, and we was coming back, and we stopped in Flagstaff. And we just stopped in a Taco Bell. Sure. Just to grab something quick. And I seen this guy sitting over there, and he looked so familiar. It turned out to be Karashinen, that one famous weightlifter.
Yeah.
It was him. So I went over and talked to him. Well, his son was lifting a tournament that day and then he was sitting with a guy who was a coach from Phoenix area.
Okay.
And this guy was kind of down a little bit because he had a lifter who just got caught using steroids got banded for a while. And he was he said, they promised me they wouldn't use it.
Sure.
He said, I go over with them. And he was hurt.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I can see how coaches would feel that way, depend on their lifter to follow them, and they're doing something else because they think to get there faster or something. But he was hurt.
Yeah,
and I think I know who he is, but I ain't gonna mention any names on that.
Right.
And I know who the lifter was, who went on someplace else and is doing well now, but at least they not getting caught using anything, and evidently not. But they did then, and it hurt that guy.
And so, maybe we have time for two more questions. One of them is, have you ever been tested, or were you ever part of the testing pool at any point?
Only in the Masters, you know.
The Masters, oh.
And it's a random thing, and, you know, it felt like it was, hey, I finally got good enough to get tested.
Yeah. Hey, somebody's paying attention.
But that's the only time.
Okay.
It was a random deal. It wasn't because I was doing good.
Yeah, it's not like your total went up like 30 kilos, and they're like, hey, let's test Bill out. Let's see what's going on. All right, so one last question, Bill. Is there something that you've lived by, like as far as like a life philosophy that's kind of driven you to this point? Like, is there something that you kind of like stood by that's kept you going and weightlifting in life, and just kind of like something that you fall back on to kind of tell yourself, like, this is how I want to be, this is how I want to portray myself to the world?
Yeah, I don't know how to explain it. It's not really, it involves my weightlifting, but the way I live is the way I thought of my dad.
Sure.
I wanted to be the kind of guy he wanted me to be.
Right.
That's my philosophy.
Okay, so just kind of looking back and say, like, what would my dad say if I did this? Or what would he think if I was saying this or doing these types of things?
My dad was a truck driver.
Right.
And where he made good money. But he always said, you know, this is the only thing I can do with no education.
Sure.
But one time in high school, he was several times, but one time particularly, he came to watch me wrestle because he happened to be in town.
Okay.
And being a truck driver, he wasn't always there, you know. And I wrestled against a guy who was George Crenshaw was his name. He was a state champion in Nebraska. And usually, we wrestled several times together, and I always beat him. But this particular time, he beat me. Happened. In just the last few seconds, what happened was I looked up at the clock, see how many seconds was left, and he took me down and scored enough points that he beat me. And when I walked off, I don't know if you've been to wrestling matches, but they always put the chairs for the team on one side. Right. I just walked over, kicked my chair, and I walked down the basement where the showers were at and started taking a shower.
Sure.
And my dad came down there and he said, you know, and I was in the shower and he came walking right in there and he says, you know, he says, I don't get a chance to get to watch you much. And he said, when I do, it's a pleasure watching you whether you win or lose. And when you come off the mat, I don't want to know where you win or lost. I want you to feel like you're glad I was there to watch you.
Yeah, yeah.
So I try to make everything from then on like that.
Right, like your dad was there to watch
you.
Damn, Bill, that's really great. I appreciate it. Is there anything else you want to add or, you know, throw out there?
No, I can't think of anything. I enjoy you guys at meets when I see you there. I enjoy your lifters. That, you know, they helped me when I fell down in Santa Fe, where I don't remember any of that until I woke up in the hospital.
Right.
Very little of it, but it was your lifters that particularly Robin and the others, you know.
Yeah. And I appreciate it. Yeah,
Amanda and Consuela.
Yes, that's how you know. Yeah.
And helped me, and I appreciated that. And it was your lifters that did it. So, and I'll always remember that.
Well, Bill, you're really, you're an inspiration to me. I want to be involved in this as long as you have, and I think you guys are a great model for, you know, being a part of the community, and you've been there. I think you were at the first meet I ever went to, the Barnhold Memorial at Define Fitness.
And, I did live in that one, too. Yeah.
Yep, I've kind of looked up to you ever since, and I'm so glad that you were able to come on the podcast today.
Okay. Yeah, I don't do too much local meets, except I go to help out, but I do like to lift from Masters. Okay. So.
All right. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. We appreciate Bill Waugh coming on and talking with us and sharing some of his experiences. And if you have any questions for us or you want to reach out, just contact us at asaweightlifting@gmail.com, or you can reach us on Instagram at albuquerquestrengthacademy.com. Once again, thank you, Bill. Thank you for coming on. We appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Until next time, y'all. Happy lifting.